I'm Perry Farrell. I'm at Fredrik Stroge's home studio, and it's called...
Hemma hos Strage is the name of this podcast, and I'm super psyched to have you here.
Okay, thank you.
welcome, Perry.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What made you start Lollapalooza back in 1991?
It was a little frustration, artistic frustration. So I was then in Jane's Addiction, and we had put out the album Ritual de lo Habitual. But we had been at odds with each other. And although we had put out what I considered a beautiful recording, the band personally was not getting along, which was a shame. But I thought this was going to be my last tour with Jane's Addiction. And so I went to my booking agent, Mark Geiger, at William Morris Agency, and told him this will be the last tour I'll do with Jane's Addiction. And he said, well, then you should make it very special. What would you like to do? And I started writing a list down. I wanted hot air balloons, and I wanted art galleries and everything. So that's what led me to creating Lollapalooza.
And Jane's Addiction were really big at that point. You were on the verge
ascending,
of, you know, becoming one of the
yes.
biggest rock bands in the world.
Yes, we were at that time.
But you fell apart.
Well, it's more that we fell apart. We had an internal combustion explosion.
And on the very first night of the Lollapalooza tour, got into a fist fight with your guitarist.
Yeah, it wasn't fists.
Dave Navarro.
It was more like wrestling.
Wrestling.
It was wrestling body slams.
How did that come about?
Really what led up to it was, you know, I think a lot of it had to do with we were overworked and under-rested and constantly being pushed, you know, go out there on stage. And we were also all drug addicts. So our first show was in Phoenix, Arizona, which was very hot weather there in the summer. It was in the hundreds. So Dave needed to get off the stage, if you know what I mean. And
because
he wasn't feeling well.
Okay.
I wasn't quite as understanding as I would be today about it. And we had given them, the audience, a short show. So I asked them, you know, no, we can't. This was like a 45-minute show we were giving them, and we were headlining. It wasn't enough time. So I said, no, we've got to go out there. And Dave said, oh, I'm finished. You know, I'm done. I'm not going to do it. So the argument got hotter and heated, more and more heated about that. And I started to insist that he will go out. And he said, no, I'm not going to. And then I said, you will. And then I, you know, in my high school years and college, I was a wrestler. So I was...
You were a wrestler?
I was a grappler. Yes, I was.
Okay, I wouldn't think that because you have a very, you know, slender...
Yes, but I wrestled people my own size. But I knew how to leverage bodies.
Oh, you know how to body slam.
Yes, I picked him up and I did that. I'm sorry.
I find it...
I do feel like an idiot that I did that, but, you know, in those moments...
Did you hurt him or was it...
Well, he was able to finish the show. He got up and we walked out and finished the show. We did two or three more songs. But, you know, I'm a different person now.
I really remember wanting to go to the Lollapalooza tour in 1991. I was living here in Sweden. I was 17 years old. And I was a huge fan of Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Susie and the Banshees.
Yes.
Jane's Addiction. And Ice-T, who was also playing.
Yeah, I noticed. So there's interesting that day, Nine Inch Nails was having big troubles with their equipment because it was overheating. And a lot of their music was on track, back in those days, it was somewhat of a mystical scenario for people like me and Henry Rollins. We watched them and we didn't understand quite why they were, their equipment overheated, and then Trent went and just started to smash his keyboard and throw his keyboards all over the stage. We didn't understand why he was doing that, but later it's like, well, that's a good way to, it's a grand finale. If your music isn't going to come out of the speakers, you might as well just throw a tantrum.
Because they had like sequencers sort of at that point. No deaths or anything, because sequencers overheat easily.
That's, right.
But I find it fascinating that something so chaotic became something so endurable. Like, you know, because you were perhaps not the most well-organized person back in 1991, and still you created Lollapalooza, which is still around.
Yes.
And has spread to different countries.
Well, it goes to show you that what is most important is intent, intention. I was not the most organized, but my intentions were very true. My intention was to create art and bring it to the subculture, bring it out into the light so the subculture could have a day in the sun. And here we are.
Where did you get the name Lollapalooza?
Well, back in those days, 1990 was when I was, the inception of it, was very fertile time for the world. It was the first year that the World Wide Web was set up and people started to use the internet. But for the most part, I got my words from dictionaries. So I would thumb through dictionaries.
So that's a word? It actually means something?
Yes.
What's the Lollapalooza?
It means something or someone great and or wonderful. And then the second definition is a giant swirling lollipop.
That's mind-blowing.
Yeah. Hello, this is Perry Farrell from Lollapalooza, Kind Heaven, Jane's Addiction. And we're about to play Sunday Morning by the Velvet Underground. By my side, early dawning, Sunday morning, it's just the wasted years so close behind. I always think about Sunday morning because I think about waking up on a Sunday morning after we would do a performance in a club, and we would have partied Saturday night really hard and wake up, and I would put on the Velvet Underground and listen to Sunday morning. And it just reminds me of that Wilton house that we all lived in. And all the people would go after the show back to the Wilton house. And you wake up with people on your bed. It's exciting and you really feel like, man, this is the life. It's all the streets you cross, not so long ago. Watch out, the world's behind.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So where was the Wilton House?
It's in Los Angeles, in L.A., almost on the outskirts of Silver Lake, which is a very hipster place. But we were just outside of it. I had found the expression we use in America is a white elephant of a home. A white elephant, to describe what a white elephant is a home that is very large, and you could fit in a lot of your friends who are musicians, but the landlords cannot sell this home because it's either run down or it has become a bad neighborhood. Back in the glory days of Hollywood, this home was in a place that it was near Paramount Studios. So the actors would either rent these homes in this neighborhood. It wasn't far from people like Mae West had an apartment penthouse nearby, but the neighborhood had gotten run down, and of course most people moved to Beverly Hills or out to the beach, Malibu. But so anyway, I found this 6-bedroom white elephant. And the landlord could only sell it to a person like myself. Not sell it. I rented it. And then I brought in all the musicians that were on the come ups in Hollywood. So young groups, and we all collectively would rehearse in the garage of the Wilton House. And that's what the Wilton House was.
There's a special stage called Perry Stage at all Lollapalooza festivals. Do you pick out the artists for that stage?
I conceived the stage somewhat, and I have many friends and co-workers that work specifically on the booking of the various stages, and then they specifically zone in on the type of music that would be played at that stage. So I don't do daily. I'm not in the office on a daily basis, but we will have discussions about things. And for the most part, I have a great production team that has more information than I do about these things. But and happily so, because that allows me, it frees me to continue to be an artist and create my own art.
And if you go to Lollapalooza and you see something on Perry stage that you don't like, it's not as if you go up on stage and kick them off.
Me?
Yes.
No. Here's what I would never do that, because we are a sacred brotherhood, and we love each other. We're symbol of humanitarianism and brotherhood and sisterhood. And so anybody that would be performing at Lollapalooza, they're my brother or my sister. We're going to listen now to David Bowie singing Hang On to Yourself.
Oh, that's a great track.
Yes. We're gonna make it. Better hang on to yourself.
When did you discover David Bowie?
Oh, I discovered David Bowie in high school, in like probably around 1972, 73. I'm that old, believe it or not. And yeah, David Bowie and Lou Reed and Iggy Pop, they were giants. Or I could say they were titans. In my era, glam was known to certain parts of my high school that I frequented. It's the kids that sat on the wall, smoked cigarettes, and cut class, and did more than that. But we loved Bowie and T-Rex, and Bay City Rollers.
Oh, yes, yeah, that was like the biggest boy band of the early 70s.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
don't really remember them because, you know, boy bands don't go down in history the same way as
right,
glam rock bands do, but they were pretty good.
They were pretty good, and they had a great look to them. But anyway, that was the glam era, and we were into it.
Speaking of David Bowie, you work with his legendary producer Tony Visconti on your new solo album, Kind Heaven. Mm-hmm. What's he like in the studio?
Oh, he's just what you would imagine. He is very kind, but concentrated, focused, and creative. So you can count on Tony to produce an incredible record that will come out like you've dreamt it would.
I know that one of your first jobs was to impersonate David Bowie at a modeling agency in LA.
Yeah, David Bowie and Frank Sinatra and Mick Jagger.
That's a very odd way to like enter the music industry.
Well, yes, but I wasn't looking to be a musician. I was, I guess you would call it, discovered by a woman who was, she ran a modeling show and she also was kind of a madam.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so
but I didn't know that part.
Until you went on your first job.
Yes.
And they expected to.
Yeah, well, she just said, would you like to make some more money? Of course, I had very little money, so of course. And what do I have to do? Just come to this party on this yacht.
Dressed as David Bowie?
No. That I dressed as David in this private nightclub that she did. She put the shows on. She did modeling shows. And I said to her, she asked me if I was a model, and I lied, and I said, I am. Why not, right? And I wanted to see where the conversation would lead, and I said, I could make your show really good. I could impersonate, I do impersonations of David Bowie. I'm an actor, I'm a singer. So she allowed me to do those things for the show, and I became the star of the show.
But the escort thing, what did that feel like? Was it like... what am I doing?
Yeah, I felt a little awkward.
Yeah.
And things got worse and worse. I was only into that scene for a very short time. And it wasn't for me.
Did you tell your parents about
wouldn't
it?
Wouldn't be my fate.
No.
No.
Because your father was a jeweler, right? He worked with
Yes, my father was a jewelry designer. And he had... a small store in New York City. He had a booth on West 47th, which is known as the Diamond District. Have you ever been to New York City?
Yeah, a lot of times.
So you know the Diamond District where you go for jewelry. He had a booth there, and we moved down to Miami Beach. And he had a small store in Hallandale, which is just outside of Miami.
So did your parents want you to like pursue a musical career? Or
no,
did they have
not
plans
at all
for you?
When I was a young man, my father wanted me to work with him in the family business. I was a designer. he was a designer as well. So what we did was lost wax casting. That's where you design rings and pendants and links to make into chains that goes around your neck or around your wrist. And he was very good at acetylene torch, so he could repair, he could move gold and silver around with this blowtorch and make them make the gold and silver into different shapes, heat it up and it would turn to jelly. And he would make, you know, he worked with diamonds and fine gems, precious metals. But later on in his life, when I was graduating high school, his business fell off and he got more and more deeply involved with organized crime.
Really?
Oh. Yes. Well, he always kind of had a clientele that he had people that were in the entertainment industry and in the organized crime, in organized crime. They were always kind of on the outskirts of, in New York, where he grew up, which was Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. He grew up with some of the biggest mobsters in history. So,
was that back when there were like Jewish mobsters as
yes,
well?
Yes, there still are.
Yeah.
But yes, in those days, yes. The Jewish mobsters, he grew up going to high school with them. The Lansky brothers were in his grade. So, you know, in the jewelry industry, if you wanted to, you could fence stolen gems if you wanted to. So I'm sure that my father, these guys might bring him fenced items. But he was really an artist as well.
Is he still alive?
No. He died. But the reason that I didn't pursue the family business was they eventually, they came into our business more and more. And eventually, my father was invested in the numbers racket and then lost the family fortune. So my father didn't tell me all this, but he just, when I asked him, hey, I'm graduating high school now, Dad, and I would like the money that I've been working my whole life for to go on. I was going to take a surf trip, and he said, I had no money for you. What are you talking about? And me being a young man, 17 years old, I didn't understand, because he was too proud to tell me about he had lost all of our money to the mob.
And his name was Bernstein.
Berenstecher, really, originally. Oh. Berenstecher, which means a kind, handsome entertainer. Isn't that crazy? That's my real last name. Well, so they made it in short. They said Bernstein, but it's Berenstecher. If you, yeah.
And you picked the name Farrell, so you would sound like
peripheral.
Someone who's peripheral, who's on the outskirts of something, or
right.
on the edge of,
peripheral,
of
yes.
something.
Yes. A person who, yeah, I like to, I was about to say, I like to watch. But I do, I like to notice and have the be relaxed enough to kind of zone into seeing what other people are doing and not always being watched myself, but watching others. Like I do at Lollapalooza, you see, I perform, yes, but I also love almost as much to watch the groups and to listen to them.
I listened to your very first band, Psycom, which was
yeah.
this post-punk kind
yeah,
of gothic
yeah,
LA band. And it sort of reminded me of this band, Bauhaus.
Absolutely. We love Bauhaus.
This is Bela Lugosi's Dead.
White on white, translucent black capes. back on the rack. The little goose is dead. The bats have left the bell tower. The victims have been bled. That velvet lines the black box. The little goose is dead.
You've worked with the Bauhaus bass player David Jay on several tracks, both in Jane's Addiction and
you know, in Porno for Pyros. Daniel played on one of these great tracks from Porno for Pyros called Porpoise Head, one of my favorite tracks from Porno for Pyros.
So you were quite into goth in the early 80s.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Still do.
Did you see Bauhaus live back then?
I never got to see them, but one of our first tours was opening up for Love and Rockets. Oh. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I really love them.
Me too.
I was on my way to see Peter Murphy here in Stockholm late last year. I never made it to the concert, but he was thrown out of his own show because he got into a fight with the bouncers after throwing bottles at the audience.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that was a bit of a mess. But he was spectacular on stage,
yeah.
I'm told. Your first concert with Psycom was in front of a hot dog stand in Hollywood.
That's true.
How did that come about?
Well, so I fell in with the art community, the art community, downtown artists of Los Angeles. And they, of course, were creating the scene in those days with the punk rock and the goth kids. We were building the underground. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, but how did you get in touch with the hot dog stand?
Oh, the hot dog stand. Okay, so we were really castigated from the Sunset Boulevard crowd and musicians like this. At that time, Sunset Boulevard was turning into this spandex hair metal, and we were not into it, and we were also really not welcome to perform at that time up on Sunset Boulevard, where some of the great clubs of Los Angeles were, like the Whiskey a Go-Go, and there was this club called Gazzari's, and there was still the Roxy, and the Roxy still was a premier place to play, and they were welcoming people like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. You know, some of the groups were coming over from the UK and Europe and performing at the Roxy. But for the most part, we had to find our own places. And the band, Psycom, was really being led, not by me, but I auditioned for them. They were already in the scene. And their attitude was, we will throw parties downtown. If you know of a place where we could play, let's do it. And so somebody, I think I approached, along with Mariska, the keyboard player, I approached the hot dog stand. So I thought it'd be a really cool place to play in Hollywood. And we could get people to come for free. And it was really more important, the optics, to get the eyeballs on us than to try to make money. Here's another interesting point. At that time, there was this attitude called pay to play, where, let's say as an example, Gazzari's, you would get the gig, they would say, okay, your band can play here. They'd give you a stack of tickets, and then you'd have to pay them $500 to rent the equipment. That's a terrible thing to do to a young, up-and-coming musician.
Yeah, that's really exploiting people's dreams.
Yes. So we wouldn't do that. And number two, we didn't have $500. So we had to think of other ways to perform. I'm about to play for you one of the great American poets of all time, Iggy Pop's I Gotta Write.
I love Iggy Pop. I love the Stooges as well.
Me too.
I read this book by Danny Sugarman called Wonderland Avenue, where he writes a bit about trying to be the manager for Iggy Pop in the early 70s, which was a very hard job.
Yeah.
Because he would thrash every hotel room and every car that he came in touch with.
Yeah.
Did he mean a lot to you as a performer?
Oh, he meant the world to me, still does. He's one of my greatest heroes.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You mentioned somewhere that the idea for Kind Heaven, your new solo album, came to you in a dream. And also you said that you started thinking of the prophet Isaiah, who lived in the 8th century, and talked about the coming of a Messiah, the Son of God.
Oh, wow.
Is that how you, you know, come up with a lot of ideas, by dreaming?
Well, I have, you know, many ideas, but I figure the deepest dreams are, they come from the deepest part of your subconscious, and that fertile area of your consciousness. And I tend to go with those dreams first, because I could be astrally projecting someplace, gathering information like a on-location news reporter, if you will. And I could be going forward in time or backwards in time even, because I believe that a soul has the ability to enter the fifth dimension, and the soul has ability, once they're in the fifth dimension, to time travel in a different way that we humans can time travel. We're not, the soul or the people in the fifth dimension are not constrained by time restrictions that we have here on Earth.
It's fascinating how you sort of mix up ideas that seem almost like science fiction with the traditional Jewish mysticism.
Yeah. Well, or you can call them
Jewish. Maybe time travel is a part of...
Yeah, but time travel to me, I mean, yes, I'm Jewish, and I do study Jewish mysticism because Jewish mysticism has a lot of information about the Word of God, God's voice, and the universe. And it goes deeper. It's almost like studying religion, but studying it as a studying the science, the true science of nature. And that includes all of us. And that's what I really think I'm studying, and what I'm really interested in, what I am curious about, is us, all of us, not just solely Jewish people. Although I love Jewish people, but I love you just as much as I love my relatives.
Something that I find fascinating about the Jewish faith is that there really is like a study of the Torah where people discuss it and debate it and even criticize it. It's not a, you know, necessarily a worship activity.
Right.
But there's this part where you actually can question the Word of God.
Well, and, you know, check it out. I would suggest that, and I have, you know, you have a picture of Anton LaVey on your wall. I have researched, I have read everybody's, I am a comparative religion studier, so I could consider myself a theologian, even into the darkest realms of, you know, black magic I've studied. When I was younger, it really interested me, and then I just decided to kind of stay away from it because it's like hanging out with a certain crowd that I just felt, but there's no really need to hang out with that crowd. It's just, what will it lead to? So I went on, and I've read, you know, I've read the Gita, I've read Book of Mormon, I've read, you know, the Quran, I've read New Testament. So I have a pretty good grasp. I've read Buddhism. I have a pretty good grasp of the major religions in the world, what they are saying.
Let's listen to some Depeche Mode.
All right. You know what I was going to say? Personal Jesus? Reach out. Touch faith.
Well, let's play Personal Jesus.
Okay, Personal Jesus. I was going to suggest that. How synchronistic, right? How serendipitous.
I'm a pretty big Depeche Mode fan, and I remember reading about how Dave Gahan went to see Jane's Addiction on the Lollapalooza tour in 1991, and he had some kind of epiphany there. He realized that he wanted to play a new kind of music, that he wanted to, you know, rock out.
Wow.
So he grew his beard, and he got tattoos, and he developed a not, you know, not so healthy lifestyle. Did you meet him back then?
You know, I'll tell you a really weird story. We went to the UK for the first time. We were going to do one of the big festivals that I ended up to cancel. Unfortunately, I didn't have my voice when I came across the pond. I performed this small little club, lost my voice, and I remember seeing Dave kind of almost waving at me as I went from the stage to the dressing room, like he wanted to meet me. But I was kind of rushed through. And I remember somebody saying, you know, Dave Gahan wants to meet you. And by then I was in the door, inside the dressing room, and I never got to meet him. When I then, of course, years later I did. But so that your story makes sense to me.
I remember seeing this picture of him in a t-shirt with the the cover of Nothing's Shocking, Jane's Addiction's second album.
Well, I love Depeche Mode too. And Martin is fantastic. They're all great. They're all great people, but it's kind of great that you also had this notion, let's play Depeche Mode.
Well, I kind of always have Depeche Mode in my head, so
really?
It's not a coincidence.
Yeah, they're almost perfect.
Anyway, Dave Gahan said this about Jane's Addiction after seeing you live. He said, and I quote, "It was the most incredible thing I'd seen in a very long while. Sometimes they were really shit, and sometimes they were just so mountainous and fantastic."
Oh, that's true. That's accurate.
Dave Gahan went from electronic music to rock and roll. You kind of went the opposite direction in the 90s when you started to DJ and play house and techno.
Yeah.
And how did you get into electronic music?
Let me think about that. Well, you know, being just a huge music fan, and all of a sudden, Future Sounds of London and The Orb and Orbital and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I all came upon them around 1990-91, and I was so fascinated. The music was so very different, but there was a connection. The link was dub, so I
dub reggae.
Yes, I'd fallen in love with Lee Scratch Perry and the Anyu sound, King Tubby, Prince Farai, Mad Professor, and of course Lee Scratch Perry.
Yeah, that's really music that you can lose yourself in. It's so mind blowing. I remember when
and
I heard
somewhat that, shamanistic too.
Yes,
but electronic, and also it had the organic, it had the analog mixed in with the digital, and that's where I think Dave and you know. Reggae dub and Orb all intersect is our love of taking people somewhere. It's almost shamanistic, but using digital, using technology. So it's a really exciting medium to work within. An artist,
it's funny that you know William Gibson, the writer, he mentions dub in a Neuromancer, his like cyberpunk novel.
Sure. I've read Neuromancer.
It's interesting how, you know, dub reggae connects something very futuristic to something very, you know, earthy and
religious.
Yeah.
But when I say religious, I mean their religion is one of the greatest religions of all time.
Should we listen to some
Rastafari?
Dub reggae?
Yes.
What dub reggae track would you pick?
I'll tell you what. Do Adrian Sherwood, something by Adrian Sherwood.
This is Starship Bahia. I remember reading about how Lee Perry would, you know, record something and then bury the master tapes in the ground in his garden so that they would be, you know, full
of earth?
Well, no, he buried the master tapes underground so that they would, you know, receive some kind of holy power from Mother Earth.
Really?
So he had them, you know, buried them in the ground for a few days until he sent them off to the record company.
Oh my God.
That might be a myth, but I'm... Back when grunge was sweeping the whole world and a lot of people looked quite plain in lumberjack shirts, you looked like this androgynous Ziggy Stardust surfer, shamanic creature. How much do you think about style and fashion these days?
I hate to admit that I'm such a fashion whore. because if we're... talking about mysticism and escaping the mundane world and not caring about, you know, mundaneness of trivial things like clothing and articles of clothing. But I just love to dress up. Yeah, I waste so much time.
You do?
Dressing up. Oh, yeah. I'm always late.
And you're wearing very nice sneakers today.
Thank you.
They're like...
They're like, what do you call it? Miami Vice meets
Buffalo
Stardust.
In a way. The heels are pretty chunky.
They're Fluvogs. John Fluvog. I was just in Toronto, where John Fluvog lives, and I was looking for platform shoes, and these appeared in the window.
And they're pink and turquoise?
No, salmon.
Salmon, sorry, salmon.
Salmon and white, turquoise, and smoke. Smoke platform, which is like a light gray.
Bands like Jane's Addiction and maybe the Pixies and Sonic Youth pushed the music that was called alternative rock into like the mainstream in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Do you still think that the word alternative means something, or is it... difficult to use it these days?
Well, I like the term because I believe the term came about because we were all beginning to discuss alternative energy. That era was the era when the consciousness of many was tuning into alternatives to petroleum and, you know, gas and those types of energies, nuclear, into wind and solar and thermo. And so we were talking about alternative energy. And Lollapalooza, as a matter of fact, had Greenpeace coming along with it. And I had started a nonprofit called Voice of the Land, where we went to the White House and performed on the White House lawn, asking them to do something to help. We had bought acres and acres of land in Costa Rica, rainforest, that we left preserved for all time's sake, that nobody can touch that land, specifically for, you know, leaving the environment where they could generate oxygen. So the term kind of bled onto the musicians. Alternative rock, because we were alternative to the hair metal spandex that was coming as the result of, I think in part, New York Dolls. I love the New York Dolls, but there were some pop rock, giant stadium pop rock. People were trying to attain that, and I won't name names of bands because I don't need to, and in all honesty, musicians, we're all trying as hard as we can to entertain you, so there's no reason to pick on anybody. But the lyrics, I think also the intentions of those groups was just, it was stale, you know, trying to be rock stars for being a rock star's sake wasn't very interesting, and I think it was generating uninteresting music as a result. The alternative kids, we still looked up to, our idols were the punks, the Sex Pistols, and the Clash, and Joey, and the Ramones, and those guys. And so we weren't really after fame so much as we were after to make an impression on the art community, subculture.
It's fascinating how the word alternative came from your environmental,
yeah,
you know, activities.
Yeah.
Because you went to 10 Downing Street in 2007, yes, and met with Tony Blair.
And I spoke inside of 10 Downing Street on he brought out this, I guess you would call it a step stool, maybe a tailor, if you ever went to a tailoring house or a store, and they get you to stand up on a box, like a crate, and this was like a crate It had a velvet padding, and I stood up on it. It was only like a foot.
So you had to stand on that thing.
Yeah,
to
this man came
him?
Out with a proper wig, powder wig, and he put it down, and he told me, he just like put his hands out and pointed to it, like, "All right, now you think you've got something to say? Well, say it now."
So it's a bit like in Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park, where you stand on a.
Yes, but I was at Tim Downing. Okay. Tony Blair was there, and you know who else was there? Roger Taylor was there.
Oh,
and
from Pink Floyd.
No, from Queen,
of course.
Yes,
sorry.
and Brian May.
And you were talking about the global warming.
Yes, I was trying to impress them to help ease the effects of global warming, to do something, you know. Well, yes, I tried. And what ended up happening was I didn't succeed right then and there. But I haven't given up, of course. But at that time, I was going to try to put a concert together. And that I was requesting their help and their money. And they ended up doing a yacht race instead.
This is a song by Patti Smith called Summer Cannibals. I've sometimes thought of Patti Smith when I see you perform, because you have like some kind of way of summoning pagan spirits on stage. I'm not sure. And she also, you know, she performs barefoot a lot of times, which I've seen you do as well. But I heard this story that she played at Kids Palooza.
She did.
The children's area of Lollapalooza once. And she wanted to teach the children about the important issues in the Middle East.
Well,
what happened?
I think I wouldn't use the word teach, because she was very emotional, and it was more of an emotional reaction. That day, that morning, there had been an exchange of bombs from Lebanon into Israel, and Israel returned fire and was bombing back. And she got up there and yelled into the microphone, "Israel's throwing bombs at Lebanon!"
And this is the kids' area of Lollapalooza.
Yeah, so it's not at Lollapalooza. I have this setup where if you have children who are 9 years or younger, they can come in for free. And I have an area for them, the Kids of Palooza area, where they can learn how to make music, learn how to produce music. They can do crafts, they can get mohawks, they could dye their hair. Basically, they can punk out. And so she was playing there, and I was her backline. I was her roadie. So I was sitting there waiting for her and, you know, giving her a towel and water and this and that. And she just lost it.
So how did the kids react?
I saw a lot of like kids that were ready to cry, because they didn't know how to handle it. You know, like even my boys now, my boys are 15 and 17, and I still got to slow down, because I have to remember they've only been conscious for like 10, 12 years as a human being. But you can imagine kids that are 9, they don't know what the heck that even means. But she was really, you know, into angry. It was anger. That's what I had to kind of like dispel.
This was the first band that you saw live. All our times have come.
Don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, baby, don't fear the reaper. Baby, take my hand. Don't fear the reaper. We'll be able to fly. Don't fear the reaper. Baby, I'm your man.
Fear the Reaper by the Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
Where did you go see them?
At that time, I was living in Miami. I was going to high school, and I started to go to concerts down in Miami Beach. They came through there. They and Tom Petty and the Cars, they all came right around the, you know, that was the first year I started to go to concerts. So I don't know what year that might have been, 73, 72, something like that.
So what were the Blue Oyster Cult like live?
Did it leave
a big impression on you?
Oh, yeah, because they had lasers. They did a laser.
Lasers back in the 70s?
Yeah, they had a laser light show. I remember to this minute, the laser that came off of the guy's guitar. It was like a ruby or something like that. I don't know what it was, but while he played guitar, it came off of his guitar, came out of his guitar, and then this square... this like laser square was over our head, almost like you can almost touch the square, but it was a laser, so you can put your hand through it. And of course, there was this diffused light from smoke that came up. So I was just enamored and hypnotized by rock.
And then you went to see Led Zeppelin a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
A concert which was cut short for some reason. What happened?
So my friends and I, we had lived... one of my friends, we call him Broder, because that was his last name. Broder's sister was going to college up in Tallahassee, I believe, or Tampa. And Led Zeppelin, as close as we could get to them, was the show in a stadium up at Tampa. So we all... jumped into Broder's station wagon, his mom's station wagon, and it was probably 3 or 4 hour drive, and we were going to get to see the mighty Led Zeppelin. That was our favorite group. We knew everything about Led Zeppelin. We would wait for their records to come out. You know, months in advance, we'd hear that the record was coming. And so... you couldn't have been more excited to see a group in your life. And Florida rains a lot. So we were in that stadium. We were back about, oh, we were near the cheap seats. Maybe we were in the cheap seats. They were not specks, but I could see them. They were as big as your pinky fingernail. And out they come, and the first song they did was... I have a dream. That's it. And when they slowed down, I have a dream. And it was my dream to see them. And all of a sudden, it starts to pour. Florida style, where it's almost like they have hurricanes down there. In fact, the college team is called the Miami Hurricanes in Miami. So it started raining harder and harder. And after one song... that song, I think they might have tried to get off one more. They said, Robert Plant said to the audience, we're going to take a break because of the rain. Are you cool? And we all went, yeah, we're cool. And then they walked off the stage quickly. And we were talking to each other. Wow, what's going on? This is amazing. And, oh my God, it's raining so damn hard. And then after 5 minutes, nothing was happening. All of a sudden, we hear this sound. And we look over the stage, behind the stage by about 100 feet, a helicopter picking up, the lights in the helicopter, waving around the stadium and take off. And I tell you, I could tell, uh-oh, I don't think they're coming back. They never did.
What a sad story.
Yeah. You're about to hear Transmission by Joy Division.
When did you hear them for the first time?
Well, you remember that crew of downtown artists and musicians that I told you about in Los Angeles. So this was my first band was formed in 1982. So 1981, thereabouts. I mean, 1982 is when I first started to perform. But prior to that, I was looking around for a group to sing, and what I would do is I would look in the free LA weeklies, and in the back of them they had a band section, you know, band looking for singer, must like Psychedelic Furs, Joy Division, Cure. So I auditioned for those groups, and ran into Rich Evac, who was our bass player, and he was the smart, intelligent guy he was married to Mariska, but he was the smart, intelligent musician who started to turn me on to Joy Division, Bauhaus, and all these other amazing subculture musicians and also authors. You know, William Gibson, William S. Burroughs, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, yeah, I fell in love with Joy Division to the point where I was working at that time as a graphic artist. And I worked at a graphic arts house. It's hard to explain, but back in those days, graphic artists didn't have the luxury of resizing their fonts on software, touch of a button. They had to go to a graphic arts house, and we had these big cameras they called stat cameras. So I remained in a dark room all day shooting stats for people. And I also did cards for people, you know, personal cards that you hand out, and for magazines, I did artwork and posters and things like that. But I would stay in the dark room, listening to Joy Division over and over. And
Joy Division in a dark room—that's the perfect place.
Yeah. Well, Frederick, I need to be on my way. I am going down to the grounds of the inaugural Lollapalooza here in Sweden. So it's been great speaking with you, and I hope that you'll come down and join me at my compound.
I sure will. Thank you for coming over, Perry. It's been a true honor.
Thank you. Same here. Gather up now, let's go!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.